Hi, my name is Lauren Templeton, and you are listening to Investing the Templeton Way. This podcast is for anyone interested in learning more about investing. In this podcast, I will be interviewing some of the greatest minds from the investment community and exploring topics ranging from international markets to behavioral finance. To learn more, please visit us at investingthetempletonway.com. The information presented in this podcast or available on the website is not intended as and shall not be construed as financial advice. This podcast is produced for entertainment value. Investing is inherently risky, and I encourage you to seek financial advice from a professional who is aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the Investing the Templeton Way podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Templeton.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Phillips.
And this podcast, we bring you thought-provoking conversations with experts and leaders across the investment industry. And today, we are thrilled to have Matt McLennan as our guest, who is portfolio manager and head of global value at First Eagle Investment Management. I personally have been an investor in First Eagle for many years. With over three decades of experience in the finance industry, Matt has been recognized as one of the top investment managers in the world. He has been with First Eagle since 2008 and has been responsible for managing the firm's global value strategies, overseeing over $80 billion in assets under management. First Eagle itself manages $124 billion. Throughout his career, Matt has been a vocal advocate for value investing, a philosophy that seeks to identify undervalued stocks that have the potential to outperform the broader market over the long term. He's a sought-after speaker and has been featured in numerous publications, including the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and Barron's. In today's episode, we'll dive deep into Matt's investment philosophy, his approach to managing risk in a volatile market, and his outlook for the global economy. So without further ado, let's welcome Matt to the show. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you so much, Lauren. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. So I always like to start these shows just getting to know you a little bit better. It sounds like you had an interesting childhood and you grew up in Australia. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was actually born in Papua New Guinea. The first 6 years were there, and I grew up in Australia thereafter.
Wonderful. So how in the world did you become interested in investing and pursuing this career?
Well, you know, sometimes in life, you have to make all the right mistakes before you chart a more reasoned course. And, you know, if I'm honest with myself, and I think back to when I was a teenager in the 1980s, I was kind of enticed by what was going on with the corporate raiders at the time. They appeared to have sort of discovered this magical elixir to create wealth. And the stock market, you know, as a teenager, sort of seemed like some stacked game of Monopoly to me. And of course, we all know later that the leverage and the overvaluation that these raiders paid and their behavioral hubris all led to some spectacular implosions in later years. But at the time, it seemed like they were onto something. And at the same time, I had a high school math teacher who figured that he'd discovered the hidden pattern in charting the Dow Jones. And unfortunately for him, he put his discovery to work and tried to trade futures around this discovery and lost it all. And, you know, I sort of reflect back on that period and I think to myself, you know, why did I get attracted to get rich quick type speculation early on in life, as opposed to what I'd now think of as investing? And I think, you know, as we sort of discussed, I was fortunate enough to have grown up in Australia in an incredibly happy house in the woods, and, you know, surrounded by books and a supportive family. But it was also a childhood that was very sort of simple and of modest means. We didn't have electricity or running water in our house in the woods, I guess I had some youthfully naive fire in the belly at that stage, and that had sort of exceeded my wisdom. And with the benefit of hindsight, I'd say, though, that I was better to have been attracted for the wrong reasons early on when I had very little capital to deploy. And, you know, out of I guess the ashes of that period of not so great market history, I took the opportunity to devote myself to learning, studying finance, accounting, law, economics, academic literature. I basically devoured it all. And I was fortunate enough to be hired by my thesis supervisor at the time into an investment job in Brisbane, Australia. And there I got to meet a range of third-party managers, and that gave me the opportunity to sort of distill the threads of continuity amongst their approach. And, you know, I ultimately joined Goldman in the early 1990s, and I was well mentored there by folks who'd worked for people like Lou Simpson at Geico or Lou Sanders at Bernstein. And, you know, I continued reading and learning, and I really just settled on a value approach to investing, really looking for businesses that were entrenched and cheap. And I think what I took time to learn was that, you know, investing done properly is all about compounding out at a satisfactory rate of return and avoiding the permanent impairment of capital rather than swinging for the fences. And, if I look back on my childhood, my mother's approach to gardening was probably a much better metaphor for investing than the actions of corporate raiders or stock chart speculators. And so that was really what got me involved in investing.
Yes, it's so interesting. Everybody finds their way to investing and value investing on a different path. So it's interesting to learn yours. Well, you've been at First Eagle now for over a decade. Can you talk about the investing landscape and how it's changed over the years and how you've adapted your approach to stay ahead of the curve?
So yeah, it's coming up on 15 years at First Eagle. It's been a wonderful experience. And I think you know, the beauty of the job of being an investor is that the learning curve never stops. And it's a field that really has sort of knowledge consilience, if you will. You know, you're blending science and humanities, looking for some sort of asymmetry between price and prospects. It's endlessly interesting. And I think as I reflect on the last 15 years, I mean, part of the journey for us as a team at First Eagle has been really sort of focusing on how to think about the evolving mix of the underlying investment opportunity set to businesses that are characterized by more intangible assets, as opposed to tangible assets. And that requires somewhat of an evolution of thinking. And, you know, that's been an area that we spend a lot of time thinking about, in addition to reflecting with a wary eye on some of the imperfections that we see in the financial architecture globally, and thinking about how we should navigate potentially troubled waters in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think just from a value investing standpoint generally, it was kind of an evolutionary process. Maybe you share that view, Matt. I'm not sure. But when you're kind of focused on the balance sheet and assets, you're dealing with historically accounting conventions that were made close to 100 years ago and have no perception of what we're looking at today. And so it creates these kind of interesting perspectives. What do you do with capitalized cost? You know, are those intangible assets actually worth something? Should you be valuing them? And so I think value investors generally have had to come to grips with that. What has been your experience?
Well, I think you're 100% right. I think when you look at a traditional capital intensive business, a lot of the investment in that business is really only captured in the cash flow statement. You know, if you're expanding your railroad network or your steel plants or you're building new buildings, you know, all of that goes through the cash flow statement. And, you know, if you're a company that's built upon intangible assets, whether it's research and development or advertising or having a unique sales network, whatever it might be, if you're trying to expand that business, you're going to be investing through the profit and loss statement. You know, one really has to sort of adjust for those kinds of differences. And I think just from a balance sheet standpoint, you know, often the two most valuable assets don't show up on the asset side of the balance sheet. And by that, I mean, you know, for a business, the most valuable assets often a high level of market share that's been stable generationally. That kind of entrenchment is a very valuable intangible asset. Incumbency is a very valuable intangible asset, but it doesn't show up on the balance sheet per se. Likewise, the extent to which there's management acumen in allocating capital over time, that doesn't show up on the balance sheet. Yes, there's trace elements of it. You might have a balance sheet that's not that levered or getting high returns on capital, but there's no discrete accounting for those assets that are incredibly valuable. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And, it, you know, at the end of the day, growth is only valuable if it's profitable. And the precondition for profitable growth is really some form of advantaged incumbency and a management team that focuses on that core advantage and, you know, focuses on efficiency and you know, deploys measured behavior. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about those variables that are kind of hard to capture in just a financial statement analysis.
Well, now that we're talking about growth, I mean, we have been through just the most incredible period with low interest rates and a misallocation of capital. Of course, the extreme valuations of growth stocks, which have somewhat corrected. I mean, Scott and I were counting over 700 stocks in the U.S. at the beginning of 2021, trading at a price-to-sales multiple of over 20 times. Just some really extraordinary valuations. How have you experienced sort of the rationalization of the market and this higher interest rate environment? Have you done anything in your portfolio to reposition, or how do you think about that?
Well, you're right. 2021 was a pretty extreme year in markets, and I think it'll probably go down as a generational low in the cost of capital. You know, sovereign interest rates were low, they were below 2%. Credit spreads were low. You know, high yield credit spreads were only 250, 260 basis points. And as you point out, earnings multiples were high, revenue multiples were high, price per human was high, you know, and the capital markets were wide open. You had SPACs, you had, you know, all of these high growth IPOs. And in fact, I hadn't seen anything really like it since 1999. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously that generational low in the cost of capital, when combined with exceptionally accommodative fiscal policy, produced inflation. And what we saw over 2022 was somewhat of a normalization of the cost of capital. Interest rates went up to levels more consistent with the historical averages. High yield credit spreads blew out to a little bit in excess of their historical averages, and earnings multiples on the market came down to levels more consistent with the last couple of decades' averages, albeit not cheap. And, you know, we fortunately weathered that storm reasonably well, in the sense that we hadn't really participated in those pockets of the market that were pricing excessive optionality. We'd sort of stuck to our knitting, stuck to situations where the investing arithmetic made sense between the free cash flow yield today and the measured pace of growth and intrinsic value. And, you know, people would often ask, you know, how do you know how to time value and growth? And I said, you don't know, but I do know that arithmetic, you know, ultimately works. And so there wasn't a lot that we had to do differently. We had during the preceding years been positioning the portfolio for more resilience, sort of leaning into the wind a little bit. And I think that positioned us to sort of endure last year and to be able to put a little bit of capital to work in the summer. But I think that the place that we're at now is a little tricky. I know markets have recovered some and are perhaps looking forward to lower inflation and interest rates. But as I sort of reflect on the current environment, I feel that the increase in the cost of capital that we've seen hasn't fully flowed through to the economic reality. And I think, you know, the bond market is flashing some warning signals here. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the yield curve inversion, whether it's the Fed funds rate itself bursting out on the upside of a 40-year downtrend, whether it's high yield credit spreads being wider. And I think we're also starting to see some signs of slowing economic momentum. You know, some of the expectation surveys, new orders for the ISM services and manufacturing new orders, or the Conference Board consumer expectations. There's signs of the labor market softening at the margin. And so, you know, unfortunately, when the momentum shifts negatively, you know, it tends to run for some time. And so I think this is a moment in time where We might have seen the early stage of the adjustment of repricing, but there may be more challenges that lie ahead.
So tell me why your portfolio at First Eagle is well positioned to weather that market if we have a hard landing, recession, et cetera.
Well, let me say up front that we have enough humility to recognize that if we have a hard landing, no one's going to be immune from that in totality. That, you know, we are a long only manager, and you know, we have over 70% of the portfolio invested in equities, but our hope would be to avoid the worst of potential permanent negative impairments of capital during a downdraft. And we have enough ballast in the portfolio between our cash and our gold holdings to not only be able to sort of weather a storm, but to be a selective purchaser of securities that offer a deeper margin of safety in a more distressed environment. And the one thing that is kind of weighing on me here as I sort of think about markets and the issues that we went through with the recent sort of banking crises is that, you know, what we might be seeing here is the opening stages of a more of a sovereign credibility crisis in the United States. If you think about the last few cycles that we've been through, in the late 90s that we talked about before, the credit problems emerged in the corporate sector. You'll remember the Enrons, the WorldComs, those situations. And then in the mid 2000s, you know, people had moved credit wise into housing credit, mortgages, you know, low risk credit, you know, house prices never go down. And, you know, I think where's the excess stack of debt today? It's in the sovereign sector. Especially following the large fiscal stimulus with COVID, there was a huge amount of sovereign debt issuance. And one of the things that strikes me as a kind of a very meaningful difference between what we saw in the most recent year and what we saw in 1999 is that you'll recall back in 1999, the last time we had about below 4% unemployment, that there was a budget surplus in the United States. Mm-hmm. In the last year, with 3.5% unemployment, we had close to a 6% deficit. And so we're not on a fiscally sustainable course.
Right.
And if you think about where the problem surfaced in the banking sector, it was losses on sovereign securities, whether they were longer dated treasuries or whether they were mortgage-backed securities with the implicit backing of the state. And I think one of the ironies of our financial architecture is that for banks, sovereign assets have close to, you know, either zero or low risk weighting, depending on the nature of them. Yet we know that sovereign debt is not risk-free. If you have unsustainable fiscal policy or you have sort of inappropriate monetary policy, you can suffer meaningful capital losses.
Sure.
And so I think we're maybe at a moment where the confidence in the sustainability of our fiscal picture could come into question. And I think that presents a whole host of different challenges for investors.
It sure does. It's very interesting time to be an investor and to think about positioning the portfolio for that. So First Eagle has a great history of preserving capital on the downside. That's what we like about First Eagle. When we're looking at putting First Eagle on our personal portfolio or talking to clients about First Eagle, we like the history of preserving capital on the downside. How as a company do you have the culture, how do you keep your wits about you in these crazy irrational markets like the one we've had over the past 10 years? How is that so preserved into the culture at First Eagle?
It's very challenging psychologically because in an environment like 2021 or 1999, you have to be willing to be short social acceptance. Ultimately, people will view what you're doing as sort of static and not keeping up with the times in a moment of exuberance like we saw in 2021. And part of what we do is to spend a lot of time being frank with our clients about who we are and who we're not, setting realistic expectations. And I think that's important because if you promise to be all things to all people, then you're almost forced to change with the times rather than to chart a steady course. The second thing is that, we have, I guess, the benefit of an approach that's been time tested. I mean, the global strategy traces its roots back to 1979. And so I think that the fact that you're acting as custodians of an approach that's been time tested gives you some staying power than if you're experimenting with a newer approach. And then I think it's, you know, it comes down to the sort of the simple fact that, you know, when we look at the portfolios bottom up, you know, we invest in what makes sense. You know, if we're worried about fiscal issues and monetary policy, then it makes sense that we hold some gold as a potential hedge. In fact, when I look at the last century of investing history, when equities have had their lost decades have often been when gold has had its best decades. And so having some anchor in a potential hedge like gold gives us the patience to endure extremes in markets. And I think just seeing opportunity bottom up, even though the market itself got pretty expensive, you know, the international stock universe was at a 50-year low relative to the US. If you just looked at the ratio of the MSCI EFA and compared it to the S&P 500, it was at a 50-year low. And so for a long-term investor for whom the arithmetic matters, the combination of sort of cheap currencies and higher free cash flow yields gives you the conviction, if you will, to stay the course. And then, you know, when we looked at sort of, you know, what we own bottom up, we'd see that we weren't just like skewed towards things that were statistically cheap, but, you know, we're trying to focus on businesses that have scarcity value, and that have innate persistence, whether, you know, if we're in the world of, newer companies, we have entrenched software, but more mature companies that aren't excessively valued, or, locationally advantaged scarce real assets, or companies that have local market services density, you know, 50 or 60% market share in local markets, or companies that have generational brand equity or heritages of like honing precision products. When you look at the nature of the businesses we own, you just start to get more comfortable that these are businesses that should grow in a measured pace over time. And if they offer attractive free cash flow yields, give you the ability to generate sound, real returns. And so it's, you know, keeping centered amidst these kind of crazy times is really a function of having a clear philosophy, a clear sense of true north, but also feeling comfortable with what you own bottom up. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of those two variables.
You know, one of the things that I think is a little bit unusual about First Eagle is your gold position. I mean, that's what I always think of when I think of First Eagle. I think about, you know, there's going to be some exposure to gold and gold mining stocks. The other thing I think about when I think about First Eagle as a manager, and please correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, because I certainly could be, but I think that compared to most managers in the industry, First Eagle will at sometimes have larger cash balances in the portfolio than the average manager, maybe as much as 30% in the past. Do you want to comment on the use of gold and the use of cash in the portfolios and the strategy behind that?
Sure. So, you know, I think that our philosophy is one where we're almost better thought of as business gardeners or business collectors than we are stock traders. Mm-hmm. And that means that when we approach the task of investing, we tend to have a more absolute mindset. And the reason I mention that is that, you know, we only put cash to work if we find a business we like at a price we like. And there are some environments where it's harder to do that. And we might be trimming names that have become more fully valued. And so the cash will build as a residual of that disciplined approach to investing. And then in windows of distress, all of a sudden there's fewer stocks that we want to sell because they're trading with a wider margin of safety in price. And there are businesses that may have been on our wish list that are all of a sudden attractive to us. And so we put that cash to work. And if you look over the last 15 years, our largest cash drawdowns were in Q1 of 2009 in the wake of the global financial crisis, and in Q1 of 2020 during the COVID mm-hmm. distress. So the cash is really thought of as a sort of deferred purchasing power. We want to be primarily owners of business, but we only want to do so on sensible terms. And so the cash will ebb and flow throughout the business cycle. The gold is in some ways a longer term form of deferred purchasing power. The problem with cash is that, you know, over the last 50 years, the yield on cash has been less than the rate of money supply growth in the economy. And so while it provides for nominal stability in the short term, it's a different form of wealth destruction over the long term, because you're not keeping pace with the rate of monetary creation. Gold is a little different from cash because it offers no yield, but it's constrained in supply. And in a way, it's perhaps not surprising that because we broke the link between our currency and gold in the early 1970s, because we didn't want the discipline of gold, it's perhaps not a surprise that gold has outperformed our money over time. And so, you know, over the last 50 years, money supply has compounded out at 6 or 7%, cash has been closer to 5%, and gold has been north of 8%. And gold, ironically, is interesting for us as a potential hedge. And people say, well, why would you hold this sort of useless lump of yellow metal? And I'm like, the paradox is that its utility as a potential hedge is its uselessness as a commodity. Anything that's useful has its price being very sensitive to the business side. Yeah. You know, iron ore, copper, mm-hmm. Land prices, whatever it may be. Gold is chemically inert, which means that it tends to be more inversely related to the business cycle. In fact, its inertness means that it lasts indefinitely, and it means that it has a more steady supply because the gold mined in any one year is only 1.5% of the total amount of gold outstanding. And so it's very predictable supply, and it means that gold's price tends to be inversely correlated with real interest rates. And over time, because of its scarcity, it tends to go up in line with money supply and nominal activity. And so, as far as hedge assets go, we found it more attractive than, say, buying put options because they cost a lot to buy put options and you have to be right on the timing. And we're humble enough to know that we can't time markets. It's had a better risk reward than owning sovereign paper, given the sovereign challenges that we've outlined earlier in the discussion. So we've settled on gold as a sort of longer term potential hedge and a longer term form of deferred purchasing power. If we were to go through a lost decade in stocks or something worse like the 1930s or the 1970s, then I would imagine that you'd see us progressively start first to deploy the cash and then ultimately to deploy some of the gold in the ownership of business at on much more advantageous terms than today.
Yeah, you bring up some really interesting topics there, Matt, in relation to gold. And in particular, this idea that gold can offset geopolitical events, but really its utility comes in the negative real interest rates. And so I'm wondering, with the Fed funds futures almost unanimously saying that the Fed is going to be cutting rates soon, does this set up for one of those dynamics where the Fed, as you pointed out in your annual letter, missed an opportunity in 2021, and maybe they make another mistake and inflation and wage rates are just too sticky?
Yeah, no, it's such a great question. I think we've seen a number of policy mistakes, unfortunately, over the last few years. I mean, I think the biggest of which was the second fiscal package, because if you think back to the beginning of 2021, we'd already started rolling out the vaccine. We had business confidence had already recovered. That's the time where you'd start to dial back the stimulus typically, but we had a kind of $1 trillion type stimulus program, and now we're in a fiscally unsustainable situation. And then the Fed also changed its approach. It said, we're not going to target inflation. We're going to do average inflation rate targeting. So we're going to wait till we see inflation. And what that meant is by the time inflation was upon us, the genie was out of the bottle and the Fed could no longer tap the brake. It had to pull, it had to pull the handbrake. So the Fed, may now be, just as it sort of missed inflation risk, may be missing financial stability risk. The fact that we had a 40-year downtrend in policy rates and we've just broken out on the upside means that we're going to test the vulnerable points of the debt stack in the economy in the coming quarters as economic activity softens. And so, when you own something like gold, which is a perpetual asset, what matters is not just what's happening now, but what happens on the next roll. And it's interesting to me that, gold had somewhat of a peak back in 2020, and it started to soften ahead of 2-year rates and Fed policy rates moving up. So it's almost like gold market anticipated the need for tightening. And more recently, the gold market's had a pretty firm bid to it. And I think probably because of what you're saying, that the Fed is going to force themselves into a tricky situation where we have a financial stability issue. That means they have to ease policy ahead of solving the inflation problem, or that we end up in a recession and there are pockets of debt vulnerability and they have to ease policy to address that. And so I think gold might be sniffing out the prospect of lower real interest rates, and the fact that even though the nominal level of interest rates went up this cycle quite a lot, it's still below the year-over-year rate of inflation. And so if we get into worse state of the world from here, rates could move into more deeply negative territory, particularly if the sovereign debt dynamics are not that attractive. There tends to be an element of financial repression used to solve sovereign debt problems. And so I think the gold markets might be smelling something. And, if we look at the last couple of cycles, gold typically hasn't peaked out until the forward curve for interest rates has troughed. And I think we're probably some ways away from that. We don't try to predict where it's going to go. We're not smart enough to do that. But I do think that the behavior of gold is telling us something about vulnerabilities in the system. And the final thing I'll mention is that, and this is a harder thing to gauge, but the dollar is, let's say, 60% of world currency reserves. There's a game changer when Russia invaded Ukraine. We sanctioned the ability of the Russians to access their dollar reserves. And you have to think, if you're China or you're Saudi Arabia or someone else who's a reserve accumulator, are you less incentivized to acquire dollars as reserves now than you were before? And so that's just a provocative question that's out there. And we know from the World Gold Council that there's been more foreign central bank buying of gold in the last year than there has been for quite some time. Mm-hmm.
Those are great comments. There's one other question that I've always been curious about, and I think this is really neat that y'all do this. You not only own bullion, but then you'll go and look at the miners as well.
Yeah,
and so there's a value investing play within that. And I'm wondering just how you kind of go through that decision-making process. Like, what's more attractive than the other? Is it just valuation-driven? Yeah, or
it's a good question. We don't trade too much, but I guess our feeling is, if we're willing to hold gold in a vault, we should be willing to hold it in the dirt via the miners if there's a margin of safety in price. And so our approach when we look at the gold miners is that we look at the existing mine plans for those miners, and we look at their cost structure and what the runoff value of those producing reserves would be at current spot prices. And if we can get a meaningful discount in the public markets, we'll take that. And then we get the opportunity of their resource optionality at a very low price. If prices go up, resources that they have can be converted to producing reserves. And so, there's some incremental optionality that we hopefully get at low price through some of the miners. And one other thing I would sort of say is that, there have been environments in the past where the miners were a hedge on the potential hedge of gold, such as the 1930s, where Roosevelt compulsorily acquired gold. And one way you could own it was through the miners. And so there have been states of the world where the miners have ironically been a safer way to access gold.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Well, First Eagle, you're head of the global portfolio at First Eagle. Tell me your thoughts on the different regions of the world. I think I read that currently you have about 50% in the United States, but what are your thoughts on China and Europe and different areas of the world right now? Where are you seeing opportunities?
Yeah, so we're great believers in diversification. If you accept uncertainty as a fact of life, It means that the tails of reality are going to be far fatter than what you would predict with a statistical distribution. And that leads us to be open-minded to diversifying across industries and across the globe. And so our portfolio has been quite balanced. You know, roughly half of our equities have been in the US, as you point out, and the other half have been outside the United States. The United States has obviously been a very strong equity market, but the United States does not have a monopoly on good businesses. And so it pays to be open-minded to opportunities that you see outside the United States. And so, you know, in Europe, you know, what's been appealing to us has been some of the consumer branded goods companies that really have very strong brands that have been around for a long time, in many cases have strong emerging market footprints, and that offer free cash flow yields that are closer to 6% than the, you know, the 4% that you'd get on similar companies in the United States. You know, one of the other things that's interesting in Europe is there's a range of investment holding companies where, again, these are often stewarded by families or founders where, you know, you can essentially get exposure to the stocks that they own at a meaningful discount to the sum of the parts. And so you can get a double discount through some of these holding companies. And again, it's harder to find these situations in the United States. Throughout Asia, we see some interesting situations. In Japan, one of the areas that we've focused on over the years has been the factory automation space. There have been some, you know, Japan has the world leaders in CNCs, robotics, pneumatics, electrical sensors, all the things that are needed to automate the factory of tomorrow. And if we ever were to see a deglobalization of factory supply chains, we're sure going to need the technology that resides in those Japanese companies. You know, in places like Latin America, where valuations got quite depressed during COVID, there's, even though those economies can be wildly cyclical, there are some very cash flow generative businesses that are quite stable. Think of the brewing and the beverages industry in Latin America. And some of these companies have 60, 70% market share positions where, you know, we were able to build positions at single digit cash flow multiples. You know, these are just very attractive businesses. And the last thing I'll sort of mention, you know, in Europe is some of the luxury products companies over the years. Tiffany's doesn't exist anymore. It was acquired. My point being that one of the motivations for us to go overseas is not that we're making a tactical call on valuations, albeit multiples are about a third lower overseas and currencies have been depressed versus the dollar. But it's for the simple reason that as business collectors, there are some great businesses outside the United States. I guess we have a lot of institutional memory having been invested globally since the late 70s as an organization.
It brings up a really interesting question to me, at least, Matt. I completely understand what you're saying with the bottom-up analysis. But at the same time, I'm also thinking that you guys are also finely tuned into risk. And I would assume that includes geopolitical, of course. Where do you kind of draw the line in terms of, well, that's more institutional risk than I want to take in terms of things like property rights and some of these other factors that are more difficult for an analyst, a bottom-up analyst, to see? Where do they filter into your picture?
No,
instance, like China and some of those.
It's a great question. Well, we had no direct investments in Russia, for example. In the strategies that we've discussed today, I think that's a reflection of some concerns around things like property rights. I think China's been a little more complex and nuanced because it is so much larger than Russia. And I think one of the things that's been interesting about China is that because of the geopolitics, it's been marching to a very different business cycle than the United States. The Chinese market was going down when we were having the bubble that we were talking about. And so, we have seen, one or two opportunities over the years in, for example, Hong Kong listed property holding companies, where the holding companies trade at very large discounts to the private market valuations of the underlying real estate and typically hold much less leverage than, say, a REIT in the United States. We've also seen some opportunities there's one holding company we own in Europe that owns a stake in a Chinese company that is a very strong underlying business, and the valuation margin of safety is wide, and the European company is doing a stock repurchase. And so, you know, you have these situations where you feel that there's enough of a margin of safety in price to make an investment. You know, we've had some investments in Taiwan over the years. And so, you know, I think the reality is that you cannot avoid all geopolitical risk. And that, as we sort of started this conversation earlier on, unfortunately, there's sovereign and geopolitical risk in the United States as well. And so part of our solution is just to be diversified. There are some markets we haven't gone into, as discussed. Otherwise, it's to be diversified, to have a margin of safety and price, and to look at the underlying business character and the history of management doing rational things with the cash flow.
Yeah. Well, it is, you have so many similarities to, First Eagle has so many similarities to John Templeton's philosophy on investing, which is global in nature. And I've heard you talk a lot about the mistakes of temperament and how important it is to exercise patience, humility, and flexibility. Mm-hmm. I see that so much in the investment philosophy of First Eagle. You can see the patience, the humility, the flexibility built into the strategy. Do you have any tips or comments for investors in cultivating that right temperament?
Well, I think, you know, I would just make the point that when it comes to investing, I think to be a whole investor, there's an analytical toolkit you need, but the temperament needs to be weighed against that. I remember when I went to Egypt at the end of 2019, and I took the family through some pyramids and some tombs and things like this. And there was interesting hieroglyphics where they weigh the heart against a feather to determine the soul. Humility stems from just recognition of uncertainty. And I think in some ways, you know, when people come to investors, they're like, well, we want you to have the crystal ball. We want you to tell us exactly what's going to happen in the world. But it's far more powerful to accept that you don't know for sure, because you end up investing in each situation with more of a margin of safety. You expose yourself to a wider sea of opportunities, and the consequences of making a mistake are more absorbable if you have an error tolerant approach. And so just accepting it is really important. And I'd say the same thing on patience. You know, I think back to the gardening discussion we were having earlier today that, you know, there were many things that my mother planted that took many years to come to fruition. But it was worth the wait. And a lot of good things in life take time. I mean, you know, a great artist is only often recognized a generation or two after they've painted their work and it survived the test of time. And in investing, to us, the most predictable sources of outperformance in a world that's largely unpredictable are things that take time to play out. Like for valuation discounts to correct, it's a passage of years. If you've got a really strong business that can generate more free cash flow, that accretes slowly to your benefit over years. If management are doing sensible things with that cash flow, the benefits of that tend to accrete slowly over time. And ironically, when people look for rapid growth, or they're often in industries that are characterized by rapid change, and your ability to be certain of what a company will be worth in 5 or 7 years time is often lower in those industries with rapid change. And so, you know, we think temperament's incredibly important. We want to surround ourselves at First Eagle with people who are smart and nice, and are willing to sort of think long term.
Yeah, I've heard you comment a lot about that long-term focus and avoiding short-term thinking. And that has been a bit unusual in this past market over the past decade. I feel like investors are getting more short-term in their thinking, and that benefits will accrue to long-term, having a long-term investment horizon. What is your investment time horizon?
Well, if you look at our portfolio turnover, it's just a little bit above 10%. So if you invert that, it implies that we have about a decade horizon, which is longer than most private equity investing. There are a number of investments we've held for decades. So it's truly long-term in nature. And I think that's a distinguishing feature of the way we invest. And I think it's clarifying for people to know that if they're going to invest, they're going to own something for the long term. And it makes you think twice about the kind of business you want to put money into and the price point at which you want to do that. And I'm a great believer that there should be aggressive reflection, but only selective action in portfolio management. And I think what I see a lot out in the marketplace is aggressive action and selective reflection. Yeah. And so that's the paradox of the investing world.
And so how does that work at First Eagle as a portfolio manager? Are you making the investment decisions? Are you sitting down with a committee? Y'all are talking about different stocks. You have about 100 stocks in the portfolio and a global universe. So probably the MSCI, ACWI would be your universe.
Yeah. So if you think about, First Eagle, one of the secrets of First Eagle is that it's really a team of teams, as opposed to, you know, being about any one individual. And if you look at each of our strategies, there tend to be, two to four portfolio managers, sometimes a little bit more on the strategy. And we don't divide up the portfolios between the portfolio managers, but what we've done is with intentionality, we've typically had thought of the job of managing portfolios as kind of a partnership exercise where you acknowledge as a portfolio manager that no one on the team has a monopoly on the truth. It encourages a very sort of open discussion of ideas before we make them. And to the extent that one person on the team is not comfortable with an investment, we tend to veer to that more conservative perspective. So it's a high hurdle for an idea to come into the portfolios. And if we've owned something for 5 or 10 years and one of the portfolio managers starts to be wary, again, we tend to sort of veer to that perspective. So it tends to be a lower hurdle to exit. So the purpose of having teams of portfolio managers is to make sure that we're allocating capital prudently, to make sure that we're really stewarding a philosophy and an approach, as opposed to relying on the prescience of any single individual to pick stocks.
What are the other aspects of your sell discipline? I mean, you just commented on it a little bit, that if somebody is wary, but I almost find that it's more worrisome if nobody has any concerns about any of the positions. How do you make that sell decision?
No, it's a great question. In fact, one of the things that always provides me with discomfort is when someone says, well, what are your favorite ideas? And it's like, well, I understand every idea has its imperfections. And I think it's important to understand that when you invest, that every idea has ways that it can go wrong. And so just thinking through the ways in which things could go wrong is a good place to start. In terms of the sell discipline, you know, one of the paradox of our business is as well that it's often, hardest to sell something when it's most expensive, because in the rear vision mirror, the business has likely performed very well. Revenues might have exceeded expectations, margins might have gone up, management might have done a few smart things, and people feel good about the business. But as an objective check, we'll sometimes stand back and we'll say, look at the 20-year cumulative log returns of a stock, or we'll look at where the enterprise value of that business has been relative to revenues over the last couple of decades. And if we're really at a high point, it's a good point to sort of reassess, have we lost our valuation margin of safety? Should we be at least shrinking this position? And then the other kind of difficult thing about selling is that if something hasn't worked out, usually the market has derated the security. So you're in this sort of angst quadrant where the business is not as good as you thought it was, but the price is lower. So what do you do? I think one of the problems in more concentrated portfolios is people tend to sort of double down because they have behavioral commitment to their concentrated portfolio. It's one of the things we're very conscious of not doing at First Eagle, is not just reflexively doubling down on a stock that's down. We really like to sort of ask ourselves, is there something about the market position that's subject to fade at the moment? Or is there something about management's behavior that's highly likely to dilute us?
One question I had just to follow up on that, Matt, is how do you determine, like, let's just say a 3% position from a 1%? Do they start at the same size, or do you have more conviction in some versus others?
Yeah, no, position sizing is a really important discussion here at First Eagle. I had a meeting with the other portfolio managers over the last week where we sort of talked about, you know, let's continue to think through our philosophy of position sizing. And if I could sort of summarize it, it's a combination of the investing arithmetic, you know, the margin of safety and price, but also the degree to which we are comfortable that we fully understand the business's prospects. And so it's not just alpha, it's a certainty equivalence that matters. And so one of the mistakes that investors often make is that they'll have huge weightings in stocks they think are big discounts or have large growth prospects, but they may not have paid as much attention to the stability of the business. And so for us, for a position to be a decent size, it tends to need both a valuation margin of safety and a degree of entrenchment that we feel comfortable with, or incumbency that gives us a sense that the business is going to have clear terminal value in 5 or 10 years' time.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I guess my last question for you would just be, what's keeping you up at night right now? What should investors be most worried about right now? I would ask about the opportunities, but I think you're going to say that international markets present opportunities. We've already commented on that a little bit. What's keeping you up at night, Matt?
What's keeping me up at night is some of the fiscal and sovereign debt issues that we discussed, you know, earlier in the podcast. The fact that we're running the sort of deficits we are at the peak of the economic cycle, it worries me because if there's not a credible fiscal outlook, then that in turn affects inflation expectations long term, and it increases the risk of us entering into a window that's more stagflationary in nature. And the 1970s was not a pretty period for investing. And so, there's not a lot of political will on either side of the spectrum here, to address fiscal challenges. And when that's the case, sometimes markets force the issue. That's just one thing, at the back of my reflections right now. We try to invest in a way such that those sorts of worries don't keep us up at night. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, if the asset that's seen as risk-free is all of a sudden not seen as risk-free, that upends a lot of things in markets. And so let's hope it doesn't come to pass. You asked me the question, so I'm answering honestly. Yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time today. And where can investors who have an interest in First Eagle go to learn more about your company, your strategies, or read your annual letter?
I think it's pretty much all available on the website, mm-hmm. First Eagle website. If investors are dealing with their own wealth advisors, their wealth advisors probably have access to a range of different resources as it would relate to First Eagle. I will say that if I look at the team members of First Eagle, one thing that characterizes the team members is they've largely bought into our investment philosophy before even joining. Mm-hmm. I noticed that about our clients too, that, it's always a source of joy for me in some ways when I get to meet with clients, and many of whom have been invested with us for decades, they've really sort of internalized the mindset. And I think if you have that amongst your employees and your customers, you know, hopefully you create a business that has sustainability as well.
Yeah, well, we've enjoyed being a First Eagle investor and big believer in everything you do, and Really appreciate the time you've spent with us today. And I know our listeners will enjoy learning more about your strategy and your thoughts on global markets. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to have the discussion. I've enjoyed the to and fro and look forward to seeing you both soon.